Hello, everybody. Welcome to Crypt Chat, your weekly podcast for everything disability. Today, I have with me Jonathan Shah.
Hello.
EBD.
Hello.
And myself, David D. Today, we're going to have Sam Drummond, a author, also human rights solicitor, and a person of disability. How are we doing today?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for that, David, and welcome everyone to Crypto, your weekly podcast on everything disability. Yeah, pleasure to have you on the show today. So, Sam, please tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, really good to be here. I am coming from Melbourne on Wurundjeri land. It's quite hot here, and so I've just come from the pool, which I do quite often, and I grew up in country Victoria. I have a form of dwarfism which impacts the growth of my limbs and the health of my joints, and it required a lot of surgery as a kid. So I grew up in a single parent household. It was me, my younger brother, and my mum, and we moved from place to place. We had to face things like coming down to Melbourne quite often for medical appointments and surgeries, and navigating all the public system, which puts up the barriers that we now know as disability. And so I enjoyed my childhood, but there were quite a lot of things that were difficult, and I really wanted to move away from where I'd been. So I set my sights on studying law and had a lot of support around me to get me into the course that I wanted at Monash Uni down in Clayton, and moved when I was 18. When I got to uni, I worked out that law is a pretty dry topic in when you're doing most of it, and got a little bit bored of that, so started doing community radio, and that was a real eye-opener because I found a lot of my people. I found that people with disabilities so often are told that their voice doesn't matter, or that it's the voice of other people who should be talking for us, but suddenly I had a microphone and I could talk about what I wanted. My first show was about cheese. Or I just did shows about, the music that I liked and got to play what I wanted to play. So that was really empowering. And it led to a career in media, in commercial radio and at the ABC. And then I worked in politics for a bit, spent about 20 weeks a year in Canberra. And the flight got it a bit too much, so I ended up going back to my area of study and working in law as a lawyer in human rights and disability. And so my area of focus now is a lot of disability rights and some other rights, because we sort of recognize, I think, that a lot of the real disadvantage in our communities happens when there are multiple forms of disadvantage, and that might be, it might be from people from different backgrounds or people of different genders, or, having multiple forms of disabilities, or even coming from the country. And so I want to make sure that everyone in our community has those fundamental rights, like the right to fair working conditions, or the right to housing, the right to an education, and making sure that particularly people with disabilities, but also everyone in our community, can live a life that they love.
And little cheese is always a great conversation starter. So it's all good.
What's your favorite cheese?
Well, I did, because it's so hot today in Melbourne, I didn't want anything too warm for dinner, so I had half a block of camembert with some carrot and hummus and crackers and some tofu as well. So I'm partial to a bit of
ricotta cheese.
Ah, yep. Beautiful.
That sounds refreshing. Anyway, thank you for sharing, Sam. So, Sam, how did your socioeconomic status define how you saw treatment for your disability?
Yeah, well, I think that was in the hands of my parents a lot. So they didn't have any experience with my form of disability. And so when they found a diagnosis, first of all, they were very much shunted into a medical system that saw disability as a deficit and that did want to treat disability in that way. So when the options were presented to them and it said, we want to treat this disability rather than take down the barriers that were in my way as a kid, they said yes. So you go into a doctor's office and the doctor says, yeah, let's do a series of surgeries to try and straighten my legs, for example, some sort of vain attempt to make me look like everyone else, to make me look what the medical textbooks said I should look like. They said yes to that. And I think that was really a tough choice, but it wasn't presented as a choice to them. It was presented as, this is what you do. And what it meant for a five-year-old, I feel like in my life, there was pre-surgery as a five-year-old and there's this happy-go-lucky kid. And then post-surgery, where I woke up from the general anesthetic with both legs in full plaster and both legs broken and the plaster was too tight and I was screaming. And you know, they said, I said something's wrong, and the doctor said, he's just, you know, he's a five-year-old who can't cope with pain. And then my feet started going purple and the circulation started being cut off. And eventually they realized that they put the plaster too tight and got whipped me back into the surgery. But it's sort of this idea of treating is one that we're introduced to, and that medicine is the answer. And that, you know, for them, the choice was, if I didn't have that surgery, I wouldn't walk. And I look back at now and I go, well, is not walking the tragedy that they've set it up as? Or was the real tragedy that I lost my childhood in that moment? I think we're really lucky in Australia that we do have at the moment, although it's at risk, we do have basic universal health care. And so by the time I'd had my surgery, my parents had split up. My mum was sort of trying to juggle me and my six-month-old brother. But we still did have that option of having that surgery at minimal cost, although there are some costs involved in all that, inevitably. But if say, I was in the United States, we might have been laden with a debt that we couldn't afford. But still, you have to hire the wheelchair. You have to take time off work if you don't have a permanent job. You know, if you're relying on casual work, you have to give up that work, as mum did. And then that's really starts putting stress on whether you can pay the rent or whether you can buy food or just those basics, pay the bills. And I think right now we're seeing that play out, where we hear day after day that there's a cost of living crisis. And for the vast majority of people, that might mean that they have to get one less subscription service on their TV or something like that. But for people who are in my position when I was a kid and my mum's position when she was raising us, that can impact whether you even have a home or you can pay for the petrol to get you to school or something like that. So I feel like when you talk about socioeconomic status and how it interacts disability, we've got to make sure that people with disabilities and other vulnerable people in our community have enough to have the real basics to live that good life.
Thank you very much for sharing that, Sam.
So did you and your family struggle growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we struggled as much as some people. There were people who I look back on in some of my classes who were in a generational cycle of poverty that is almost impossible to get out of. And I was just really lucky that I had some close friends and excellent teachers who recognized that if I had a bit of a leg up, I could get into law school. I could, you know, follow my dreams in radio. But not everybody has that. And what I think that we have to make sure we all have to do is look at those people around us, look at our neighbors or those in our classrooms and those who might be in our extended family. And if they need that leg up, then just reach out to them, because a single conversation can change a whole life. Just making sure that someone has the books that they need to go to school, that makes real difference. And so forming those communities and making sure that our government is supporting us in the way that it should is vital in this entire conversation.
I've got a question also. Before they did surgery on your legs, were you able to walk?
Yeah, that's a question I got a lot. I remember my second surgery. This is all in the book that I've recently written, Broke. And one of the bits that got edited out, because you have to get a certain word limit, it sounds like a lot of words, but I had a word limit of 70,000 words, and the original copy was 110,000. So I had to cut out 40,000 words. And in one of the scenes that got cut, it was during my second surgery, and there was this girl that I remember who was in the same age as me, in the same ward, and it was sort of the first interaction that I'd had with a girl with disability, and sort of playing on that same level of we've got something in common here. And she asked me whether I could walk, and I said, yeah, I could. There was pain when I did walk, but I could. But had this realization afterwards that does it really matter? Like I thought that she wouldn't like me if I didn't walk before this, but that was such a silly thought. and that I could walk. The surgery eventually, after the bones healed, the broken bones healed, and I had all sorts of physiotherapy, and I could walk again. But in the end, that wasn't what it was really about. It was about finding myself. We shouldn't be defined by whether we walk or whether we don't, or you know what our disability impacts us. It's who we are and what contribution we can make to the community. Like you've got this fantastic podcast. That is a fantastic contribution to our community, and that is not, you know, it's not a question of whether, you know, you can see or hear or walk or whatever. You're just going out there and doing it and making a positive contribution. And that's the realization that I had in that scene that was cut from the book.
Yeah, but it's also about, you know, shifting our view, the medical model of disability to the social model of disability. Yeah, you know, we all just want to live our life without, you know, having these barriers that come our way.
Yeah.
So, you know what, yeah, we don't want to be seen as, you know, people that are sick and we need to be cured. So, yeah, it's very important to get the message out there. So, now, awesome stuff. Thank you for that, Sam. So, Sam, what role does humor play in a life with disability?
Well, I can assure you that some people with disability have no sense of humor at all. But
I can vouch for that.
It's like you can't, I don't think you can generalize about that. but it's like sometimes personally there's this difference. I think it comes through in a more dry sense of humor, because I was told through a lot of media representations of dwarfism as I grew up, that I was something to be laughed at. I was the circus man or the Oompa Loompa that was beholden to some, you know, this orange face, strange being beholden to the billionaire over the river of chocolate, or, you know, a mini me from Austin Powers, and or dressing up as jockeys and running down the main straight. People with my disability are laughed at, and to reclaim that and have some sort of sense of humor that doesn't revolve around that, but is it very self aware, is a real statement to the world that I'm not defined by that role that you've put on me. I'm defined by how I'm going to make you laugh in other ways. Yeah. And that might reference my disability, but it's in a way that I can control. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. It's always good to be, to have humor. How did your early life experiences inform your career?
As I said, I grew up relying on really strong public institutions. I went to public schools all my life. I relied on the public health system. My family wouldn't have got through without a strong welfare system and rental assistance, and just the little things like being able to get my school books. And so I think particularly in the last 10 years, but also before then, they've all been under attack, and we're just constantly trying to fend off those attacks on these things that supported me to be who I am. And I mean, trying to get my first job as a person with a disability was just ridiculous, and it shouldn't have been that hard. And it sort of relied on people being real champions and saying, okay, this guy's got something to offer. But once I got there was this responsibility to say, okay, let's make sure that person who is in the same situation that I was as a kid now has those opportunities. And so I feel like I don't have much choice in the matter, that I tell my story to try and make sure that those people know that they're not alone, but also decision makers know what it's like to be in my shoes. That in my other work, I'm fighting for fairer laws for us all, so that, you know, people with disabilities have access to a quality education, or a vision impaired person with a guide dog doesn't get a refuse from a taxi or a rideshare service, or a person getting sacked from their job just because they need flexible working arrangements has fair recourse. I mean, these are the things that get me up in the morning, and I don't think I could ever be one of those people who's just like, I'm going to do the job that pays me the most because I don't think I'd be true to those early life experiences.
You gotta have the passion. That's all it's all about. So, Sam, in what ways have you grown up with a sense of responsibility to raise awareness?
I think it's the same way, really. And it wasn't that whole series of events where I ended up, I guess, in a group of people where I was, you know, hanging out with the likes of Stella Young, the disability activist, who was just sort of at that time getting some attention of what she was saying. And as you said, to try and ring that bell of the social model of disability, but I think I think the first time it really occurred to me was there was probably about 15 years ago a race at the horse races. Someone hired a bunch of people with dwarfism to race down the main straight of a horse track for drunken race goers to have a good time. And I saw that and I'm like, that one act has just made everything in my life harder. All those times that I go down the street, I sort of just want to be seen as just another person going down the street, but instead people will wind down their window and shout things at me or take photos of me or, you know, yell or even whisper behind my back. You know it's happening. And so I couldn't sleep one night and just got up and wrote an article and sent it through to The Age, and then the next day they published it. And I sort of realized that if you feel passionate about something and you can make sure it resonates with the community more widely, then you can make a difference. But it's a real trap to fall into to just stay quiet. And I think that's perfectly fine, but I don't think I overcooked.
Interesting. You're talking about the myth of normal, or the aim to make people with disability normal. What do you mean exactly by that?
So I guess my end goal is to be completely boring. I would love to walk down the street, as I said, and just be another guy. But I know that every time I walk in a room with strangers, that they think there's a filter in their mind about what they think I can achieve, and what they think they're going to get out of me. But I see it right now. So my daughter's 4 years old, and last year at a three-year-old kinder class, when I first went into that kinder, all the kids were pulling on their parents' jumpers and saying, look at that funny man, look at that short man. They had certain expectations. But then they got to know me very quickly. And then I was just that kid's dad. You know, I was so boring to them. And those assumptions that we have, they happen as early as 2 or 3 years old. And so when I talk about normal, I talk about it in a social sense, where those kids have learned that difference is just something to be embraced and something that is a really just part of being human. But I also mean in a medical sense as well, because the doctors want to try and make us fit to this view of normality, and they've read it in textbooks, but not all of them have really grappled with what that means. And it's a really dangerous thing to do, to try and fit everybody into this one mold, because we're never going to get there. I'm never going to be 6 foot tall. And if I did, there would be real, real problems, because they would have mucked with everything else. I'm happy with who I am. It's defined everything about me and also nothing about me at the same time. I just want people to be judged for who they are. I think when doctors try and make us like the diagrams in their textbooks, they fail us as humans.
Thank you for sharing. Yeah, no, I agree. Sammy, you mentioned earlier you wrote a book about Broken. How was the journey of collating your life into words?
It's a strange feeling. I went out and interviewed all the people in my life that were really close to me, and I still have them on tape. The story starts when I was 4 years old, and so there are parts of that early childhood that you don't necessarily remember. So I had to get other outside opinion on that. And that was a really nice thing to do. I think everyone should, if they have the opportunity, to interview their family about their lives, because then it's there forever. But then I sat down, because I was parenting, I wrote the book every night for a year after 8 o'clock at night, after bedtime. And it was exhausting. But I just had to, I figured if I could write 500 words a night, then I'd get there by the end of the year, and I did. The first draft was rubbish, but I eventually got it down. But now that it's out in the public and you have the people who you've known your whole life or know very well, and suddenly they know more about you than you do of them, or the people you've never met who know a lot about you, that's a very strange feeling, and it feels like it's not my story anymore, that the story is the public's story. And that's the beauty of it, is that I've sort of released a lot of that, and I've done it in a way, hopefully, if I've succeeded, where it's not telling anyone what to think. It's just telling people, it's just showing them what it felt like to be me as a kid, and how that sounded or smelt or, you know, it tasted like even. And once you put in that situation, then it becomes their story as well. Some of the stories now, or some of the parts of the book, I've even forgotten that they're my story because people just relay it to me. And it's really interesting seeing people's reactions because they see themselves as a mirror. And so if they have a disability, quite often they'll talk to me about disability. Or if they've grown up in a single parent family, they'll really resonate with that part. Or if they grew up in 90s Melbourne or 90s Australia, there's a lot of references there of what that was like, and that's what they resonate with. The same goes with, you know, the growing up in a drought in the country. Also, all those little bits that people come and say, you know, that bit was the bit for me, and that's really rewarding, even though it was exhausting.
And has your book been published yet?
Yep, it's out. Look, I'd like to say all good bookstores. It came out in June in 2023, and it's also in accessible formats like audiobook, ebook. You can order it online as well.
For the audience out there, make sure to grab a copy. Sounds like an interesting story. Were there any challenges in confronting the aspects of your past?
Yeah, I think inevitably it's a very, very personal story. And so with that, there are parts of it that are very raw to the bone of my close family, particularly my parents. And so I think that's really hard for them to read. And that dynamic between us is pretty difficult. Like, you give up something when you become the storyteller. I hope I did people justice. I showed everyone with their flaws, including myself. I tried to be harshest on myself, I think. But when you show other people's flaws as well, like, nobody's perfect, but it's really hard to read that. And I think that was probably the most confronting thing.
Thank you for that. What advice do you have for others growing up under economic stress with a disability?
I think just that you're not alone, that it might seem every day is just another battle, but there are other people who are in the same situation or a similar situation, that there is help out there. I mean, I think this happens quite often with people with disabilities, that when I'm making a decision, in the back of my head, I know that my status quo, my go-to position is just do it all yourself. That can be really handy because then you get things done. But the downside of it is you're reluctant to reach out for help when you really need it. If I was speaking to 15-year-old Sam, I'd just say reach out for that help. You're not alone.
Sam, what are your any final thoughts you'd like to share?
it's so important to have forums like this. And it just, you know, for you all, it is an opportunity for you to just do something that you love and to reach people who want to engage with what we're talking about and just to keep doing it. It's so great. And I just think you're doing terrific work.
For the viewers out there, if you'd like to grab a copy of the book and have a read, check it out. It sounds interesting. And you heard it all from the man himself, Sam Drummond. So thank you very much, Sam. It's been an honor having you on the show. And we look forward to having you on the show in the future.
Yeah, look forward to it. Thanks, EB. Thanks, Jonathan. Thank you, thanks, David.
And for the audience out there, you can watch your group chat. You're with your podcast on disability. Join us next week as we talk about more issues related to disability. Goodbye for now.